Hello, this is John Sandelman, the CEO of Air Wellness, and thank you today for joining us at Professionally Cannabis.
Where do they go? The smoke rings I blow each night.
Oh, hello, listener, and welcome back to the Professionally Cannabis podcast. I am delighted to say that joining the pod today is my namesake, John Sandelman, the chairman and CEO of Air Wellness, one of the market leaders in the state of Massachusetts for flower and a company with a growing multi-state footprint across the US. Having made a series of acquisitions in recent times, the Air brand is scaling at breakneck speed, and I cannot wait for us to take a peek behind the curtain. So, without further ado, John, welcome to the Professionally Cannabis podcast.
John, thank you for inviting me this morning.
An absolute pleasure, an absolute pleasure. And John, you'll know, our customary question on the podcast, and the first thing that I will ask to you is, what led you to the plant?
Well, thank you, John, for that question. Let's go back to 2017. I'm managing my family office, and the family office is multidisciplinary, which means we look at private equity and venture, real estate, and the markets. John, the one thing I've learned after doing this for almost 30 years of investing and building businesses, I learned that when I stay in my core competency, when I think about investing, I tend to do well. And what I've also learned, when I stray from that core competency, I tend to lose. So over time, if you're astute, you start to learn that you're good at some things, terrible at others. And if you simply focus and can identify your talents and your core competency and strengths, that's all you need to do. You don't need to do or be all things to all people. So in 2017, I'm managing my family office after an extensive Wall Street career. And I get a phone call, and it goes like this. Hey, John, I have a great idea. Now, in the seat that I'm sitting in, that's what I want to hear, because we actually want to allocate capital. That's how we make a living. So I said, what is that great idea? What a great way to start the day.
Who's called you, John?
Someone that I've known since I was 5 years old.
A confidant.
A friend. We've never really done business together, but we've been friends since kindergarten. And so I said to him, tell me. And he said, John, would you be interested in an industry that's growing exponentially? I said, yes. Would you be interested if that industry was highly fragmented? I said, absolutely. And he said, John, would you be interested if that industry had limited access to capital? And, you know, now I'm just like dying, right? Like, okay, growing exponentially, sounds fantastic, right? Limited access to capital, amazing, because that's what we like to do, right? I'm thinking high returns here, highly fragmented. So opportunity, okay, to consolidate, which is what we like to do. So I said, what is it? And he goes, cannabis. And I say, not my core competency. So he goes, what do you mean? You were just all excited. I heard you panting on the other side of the phone call. We've been friends since we're five. I thought, finally, this is a place we could do business together. And I simply said that I'm not straying from my core competency. I don't know the first thing about cannabis. I'm not an expert in this. I've learned that when I'm not an expert, I leave that opportunity to others. And sadly, we hung up. But the way my mind works, the way my kind of investment style, I would say as we get to know each other, and hopefully this is not the last time we have a conversation, I consider myself an intellectual sponge. So once I get focus on an idea, though it may start out in the beginning, John, not to be my core competency, I can't help but learn about it. And to me, the definition of an intellectual sponge is someone that just tries to get as smart as they can from talking to experts by doing math. I'm a math guy. I'm a relative value guy. And those kinds of ideas that fall into those core strands are the ones I tend to do.
So keeping with the sponge analogy, how long were you initially soaking for before the next step?
So it took several months, but what he did do for me is keyed me into the industry. I got to tell you, John, frankly, I didn't even know there was a legal industry for cannabis in Canada at that time. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was illegal. And so I started to look at those stocks and I put them on my Bloomberg machine and I started to follow them. And they were doing extremely well. So I said, there's something here. I'm not quite sure. And then I started to look at the US market. And while the Canadian market is interesting, and my wife is Canadian, it's a relatively small market. And I've never really invested in Canada. So I certainly am not an expert on that market, even away from Canada. I started to look at the US market because these Canadian stocks are going wild. And I started to look at the valuations and they seem quite rich. And I started to ask for the research on these companies. And then it really brought me back to the US. And I said, well, you know, Canada is essentially the size of California. If there's an opportunity here, what does it look like in the US? And what I found out is that it was federally illegal in the US. Certain states were creating the ability to give access to patients in medical cannabis. And I started to look at the evaluations of those companies and they said, wow, they look awfully inexpensive on a relative basis to the Canadian companies. And what I've learned in life, just because something trades at a low multiple doesn't necessarily make it inexpensive, right? You have to figure out why is it cheap? Because what I've seen over 30 years is some things that look attractive on a relative multiple basis go to zero, right? And others are just mispriced. So I started looking and I said, well, why are these multiples on a relative value basis? This is a much bigger market trading at such a steep discount to Canada. And it turned out, John, in 2017, we had an attorney general in the United States named Jeff Sessions, and he was threatening people if they went into the cannabis business, that he would arrest them. And so I started to do more work and to see whether he actually had the authority to do that, or was it all bark without bite? And I looked at his budget, and in the latest federal budget, there was an amendment to the overall US fiscal budget that said, essentially, it was called the Robacher Amendment, and it essentially said that Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, could not use his budget to go after cannabis. Mm. So then those cheap multiples become really interesting. And I called it at that time the regulatory misperception arbitrage, which in my mind, because I have to do things that look like arbitrage, right, John? Because that's my core competency. So I'm really fudging here to get interested. So I said, well, regulatory.
You grabbed a big old shoehorn.
Regulatory misperception arb, what does that mean? There's a perception that's causing this cheapness of the multiples, but maybe since he can't really do it, it's a misperception and they're undervalued here. So now I had to take the next step, which is, let's look at the market in the US. And what was interesting, John, at that time, where a state had approved a medical marijuana market, alcohol sales were coming down, beer sales, hard liquor sales were coming down. There seemed to be a paradigm shift, maybe generational, I wasn't sure at that time, away from alcohol to cannabis. Okay, that got me really interested. So then I said to myself, wow, let's look at the market caps of all the legal marijuana companies in the world, which is representative in the Canadian exchanges. That's 40 billion at that time, very small, versus all the alcohol companies in the United States, you know, the beer and hard alcohol, maybe even tobacco, and that's like a trillion. And I said to myself, if there is a paradigm shift here, and I wasn't sure, if there was a change in the consumer behavior, there may be a convergence trade here, okay, where you sell big tobacco, you sell big alcohol, you sell the big beer companies, and you buy cannabis, because if the taste has changed by the consumer, those market caps, in my view, at that time, should start to converge. Now that, John, is my core competency, relative value trades. So that's simply how I backed in and could justify starting to invest in cannabis.
And then moving from that first step, big step that you've taken there, and your gateway, shouldn't use the word gateway, but your gateway into cannabis.
Yeah, don't use gateway. Come on. You know better than that.
I know better than that.
So what I did, John, so then I have to think about, okay, what vehicle is the way to maximize this opportunity, right? If I'm there now, right? And because I've always invested up and down the capital structure using all kinds of vehicles, whatever I thought was the most efficient way to express my personal view, right? I started off as a convertible ARB person, then I went to derivatives and relative value. So there were a number of tools, let's say, financial instruments that I could use to express this view. And I was super focused on the US. So I had this idea that no one else in the industry had up until this point, was the best vehicle, a financial instrument that I could use to express my view on what I thought would happen, okay, US relative value versus Canada, was a SPAC vehicle, which is a special purpose acquisition company. And the reason why I liked that, and I thought that was the best way to do it, the only country I could issue, because I wanted to have a currency, I wanted to have a stock, right, to start to roll up those cheap values in the US, was to issue in Canada to buy the US, plant touching in the US. Okay, that was unheard of. And why the SPAC? I understood that some investors would be fearful to invest in a company in 2017 that was not investing in Canada where it was federally legal, but I was asking them to invest in the US, plant touching, federally illegal.
And I guess the SPAC gives them a degree of separation of sorts.
Right, because when they invested day one, John, right on point, they're investing in treasuries. Until I bought something, we're just investing their money in treasuries until the end of 18 months or earlier when I start to make my qualifying transaction. So the way we set up our family office is we do it through creating mathematical optionality, free lottery tickets, right? And we can do that. Limited downside risk and exposure and paying very little for that. So taking risk with limited downside protection, costing very little. Well, that was the SPAC. If I could convince, and I wasn't sure, John, when I started, okay, because Jeff Sessions was threatening the exchanges in Canada to list any company that would touch the US plant. So the vehicle was interesting, I'd hoped, to Canadian investors, because those were really the only investors at that time. They'd get a 2% essentially in treasuries, 2% coupon with a call option. If I didn't buy anything, they get 100% of their money back while getting paid 2%. But if I did buy something and the atmosphere changed in the US, let's say Jeff Sessions left, let's say we were less aggressive, let's say their investors were okay, because they weren't okay at that time, for them to invest in the US. Like a whole range of outcomes could happen. And you were being paid for that. I said, that's the vehicle to do it. Okay. But now I needed an exchange to list me, because there had been no issuance up until this point. None of the MSOs that are out there today existed. I had to get an exchange that said, John, we'll list you, even though your attorney general is threatening, because you're a plant-touching US guy. So I went to talk to underwriters. I talked to several. Now from saying it's not my core competency, John, I'm like salivating that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And it's like no one would underwrite me because I wanted to invest in the US. I went through three or four opportunities with different underwriters, they thought they could do it. Later on, they were hesitant to do it because it's federally illegal. So I'd come over every night to my wife and I'd say, I just don't think I'm going to be able to do this, frankly. I can't get underwritten. I can't get into the markets. And it was so frustrating because certain days that I'd talk to an art, I think we can do it. I'd say to my wife, we made progress. Next day to find out, you know, one step forward, three steps back. And finally, I got introduced to a Canadian underwriter who at first turned us down, turned me down. It was just me at this point, and underwrote us. Would agree to do it. But then I still had to go to the exchange, John, and because without the exchange, there's no underwriting. So my lawyer said to me, listen, John, we know you're an honest, transparent guy. That's not necessarily a good thing in this case. I said, well, what do you mean? I thought telling the truth was what you're supposed to do here. And I pride myself on this, right? Honesty, integrity, morality, transparency. He said, we're going to sit with the exchange. He's coaching me. And he said, one of the Canadian exchanges, the NEO. And he said, they're not going to assume, because no one else has come before them, that you would want to list a company in Canada to invest in the U.S. They're not going to make that assumption. They're not going to make that connection. So don't bring it up. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, they're going to assume you're raising money to invest in Canada. He said, don't bring it up. If you bring it up, they'll never do it. So as you get to know me, and hopefully this is not the last time, mm-hmm. Within 3 minutes, I'm talking to the chairman of the exchange and the people that work with him. I said, look, I got to be honest with you. I'm here to do an arb, selling Canada the rich market to buy the cheap market. It's just an arbitrage. I'm going to do a roll up of the U.S. and I'm issuing this SPAC. And within 18 months or less, I'm going to have a company that's U.S. plan touching. So my lawyer kicks me as hard as he could under the table.
I bet.
And he has Tourette's. He thought I had Tourette's. He had, and he starts screaming at me in front of the exchange. He goes, did I tell you not to say that? And I said, I have to tell him, because when I buy the companies, I have to get the exchange approval. Why waste 9 or 18 months only to have them, after doing all that work, finding the companies, doing the deals, than to surprise them? I'd rather know today. So the chairman of the exchange says he's watching this exchange between me and the lawyer. My lawyer got so upset he didn't even ask me to step outside. And he said, look, John, I appreciate your honesty. And I think it's interesting. I don't know if we could do it. I have to meet with my board because we've never done it. No one's ever done it. We'll be back to you in 30 days. And John, that was the longest 30 days of my professional career.
Yeah, I bet. So fast forwarding to that 30 days, I'm assuming the outcome was the right outcome and you got the approval. Down the line, you start to look to make some acquisitions. If you could you tell our listeners a little bit about that, sort of what your first few acquisitions were, what were the businesses, and why specifically you were looking to target these types of organizations? And if I'm allowed an extension of that, did those initial acquisitions form the bedrock of what the organization sort of looks like now, or was that a developing, evolving mass?
It's a good question. Look, we can't ignore who we are in our history and our experiences. And so while I was less familiar with cannabis, I was very familiar with investing in companies, buying companies, and again, being a good steward of capital. You know, mm-hmm. I've always taken the responsibility of being a good fiduciary very seriously. And so I can only act in the manner and style I've always acted in. So when I looked at the cannabis companies, one of the most important criteria for me was that the companies that I looked at were currently EBITDA and cash flow positive. Mm-hmm. Goes back to the way I construct my portfolio. It's about creating free optionality, and it's about downside protection, right? But when I think about investments, I look at their returns on a risk-adjusted basis. I don't look at it on an absolute basis. And so traditionally, if I bought EBITDA and cash flow businesses, and I understood something at that time that the market was missing, was that the markets, all markets, are cyclical. That was lost on the market. It was completely at that moment a momentum market. Mm-hmm. And I have been around long enough to understand that markets don't simply move from the left quadrant to the right quadrant without pausing or correcting. And so the way I've always invested is, if I can sit at the casino forever, whatever I'm investing in or betting on will eventually come in, right? So you take that casino analogy, you apply it to being cash flow and EBITDA positive. If the markets were going to be cyclical, which I expected, because all markets are, in the good market, I'd be fine. In the down market, I'd be an aggressive buyer, when others who are not EBITDA and cash flow positive would be hemorrhaging. Just my playbook, simply. Mm-hmm. Additionally, I wanted to find the best in class assets in the markets we were focused on, right? Mm-hmm. Lastly, because I was a SPAC, there's a requirement for SPACs, for the companies they acquire, to do a 3-year or have done a 3-year audit. It's a simple requirement. So this is an interesting story. The market was relatively, so we identify cash flow EBITDA positive, hit the first filter. Secondly, best in class, hit the second filter. Great, now we're super psyched, right? And now the question is, have they ever been audited? Do they have a 3-year audit? Can they be audited? Because for many of the people in the business at this time, because it had been an illegal market for so long, John, guess what the auditing process looked like for most of these companies?
Go you think on, they hit saved? Me hit me with it.
Dude, do you think they saved receipts? I mean, right? So, I mean, it was like we were shocked what we saw. One funny story is I got super excited about this company, okay? EBITDA cash flow positive, tell me, great, first filter. Second filter, wow. You know, best in class in their market, really important to us, right? Because we want to have a significant market share in each market we go in. We want our brand to be very relevant in the consumer's mind. Okay, great. Call them up and said, folks, I got to be honest with you, though there is no honesty at this point or transparency in this business. But again, before I invest in an industry, John, even if it's interesting, if I don't have an edge, like if I don't bring something to this, there's one bar if I'm just simply investing. There's a higher bar if I'm going to spend my time in it. And when I looked around quickly, I said, if I use my skill set and experience just to professionalize it, I bring a major edge, right? If that's all I do. So I call the company up and I say, God, I love your company. And, you know, I know most people negotiating don't put that out. Love it. Everything is great. Here's the big question, John, which turned out to be the biggest stumbling block to acquire companies at that time. Have you done an audit? So the CEO says, yes. And I was like, are you kidding? That's fantastic.
I see the sort of the game show, you know, bell noise and flashing lights here.
It gets worse and funnier. So I said, well, that's great, because I've already learned the CEO really does in most cases. I really have to talk to the CFO on when it comes to this, right? To the financials, to the audit. I said, would you mind putting your CFO on? So I said, no problem. He's all excited, he's gonna sell his company. So I said, hi, I was just talking to the CEO. He tells me you've done audits before. We're super psyched. And could you tell me something about it? He goes, well, about a year and a half ago, the state came in and did a sales tax audit. I go, what? That's not an audit. So in fact, they didn't even understand what an audit was. Forget GAAP, you have to do it IFRS because we're listed in Canada. So when we think about filtering the company, right? So we think about, you know, EBITDA positive, best in class, audit, that final filter, okay, think about it as a funnel, John, made it so there were very few excellent companies to buy at that time. And one thing that no one had ever done, so no one had ever done a SPAC into cannabis. No one ever issued in Canada to roll up the US, right? And no one in SPAC history prior to Cannabis Strategy Acquisition Corp, CSAC, which was the predecessor to AIR, had ever done five acquisitions into a single SPAC. And the reason was, John, what I learned later on in life, it's because it's nearly impossible to get all five companies to close on the same day, audit all five companies, because we had to do their audits, because no one had a three-year audit in the entire industry. So we had to do it for each one of the companies. But we ended up buying an initial portfolio that was excellent. And to your earlier question, that became the basis by which AIR was built.
And so, John, you've now got these five organizations. They're part of your SPAC. They're part of your parent organization, and they are all rocking and rolling. You've audited them. They're in better shape than lots of the other folks out there in the space. Now, looking at how you've then grown the portfolio and sort of gone on to make a number of other acquisitions, I guess something that I'm really interested in here, and that is, how do you ensure that these companies retain the, well, I guess retain what made them special enough for you to go after them, but I guess perhaps adopt the company culture and the ethos that is formed within your vision? How do you ensure that they sort of operate in a way that really is culturally aligned with yourself, but keeps the energy and the spice that intrigued you at first?
So it's a great question. It's not easy to do. And there were questions, frankly, at the time, whether I could do it. But you don't know me well. I'm a culture guy. I'm a vision person. Mm-hmm. And what is culture to me? Culture, I've always had businesses where it's a culture of excellence, right? It's a culture of mutual respect, honesty, integrity, transparency. I thought it's simply if I was just the most transparent company in the industry, which was really in the shadows at this time, right?
Yeah.
That might be enough for investors so that it would become an investable asset. Like I understood what an investable asset, because I'd done that my whole life, right? So I think about AIR, I think about every business I bought. To a certain extent, this is my playbook that I've done my whole life. It's a culture of excellence, a culture of mutual respect. And the leader has to have a very strong vision, okay, of where they want to take the company. And it's about the buy-in, right? I don't want to be the best cannabis company. I say to my team, we're almost 3,000 people. There was just me in 17. I don't aspire. A culture of excellence doesn't aspire to be a great cannabis company. It aspires to be one of the best CPG companies. And frankly, when I get on an airplane and there's a sticker to the right of the door and it says, Forbes voted this company as the best place to work. It's about creating an environment where great people, talented people want to come. And I've always been a lover of people and talent. I've always had this saying that talent is for free. No matter what I paid, my talent, what they bring to the company, you can't even reward them. But you have to have the vision and the ethos and the culture to attract the best. That's AIR. That's every business that I've ever been associated with. You know, I have a line that I love, and I think there's a message embedded in what I'm about to say. I think for all of us, God has given us all a genius. We don't have to be Einstein, but we all have talent. And so what I say to my teammates, to the people we're talking to join. Find your genius and pursue your passion. So what do I mean? It's kind of code, right? There is a subliminal message in there, John. Find your genius.
I know that folks listening to this who want to know the recipe to the secret sauce. What can you, which ingredients can you divulge?
So when I say find your genius, let's create a company whose atmosphere is it allows for people to find their genius, to be whoever they want to be, but they feel supported to be who they always wanted to be. And then with that support and culture, they'll pursue their passion. Find their genius, pursue their passion. And if we can have 3,000 people all passionately working towards the same vision, as I say, if I can have 3,000 people all pulling in the same direction, we win. The most precious asset on our balance sheet is that culture. So when you ask me on M&A, the perfect deal, and I've said this from day one to our M&A team, is where we get a best-in-class asset, but equally as important, we get more talent, because whoever has the most talented individuals on their team, because it's all about the people, wins. So the best deal, I said to my team, because we hadn't done M&A together as we came together, said the definition for me, best in class asset, and we get more partners, we get more teammates, we get more talent. And that's why I don't care about getting the last penny off the table. Because if you want more partners and you want people to join the culture, you want them to be happy, you want them to be aligned. And if you do a deal that's too tough, you won't achieve it. And so we have built the infrastructure in this company at the day of closing. Our operational stack, our tech stack is so robust that we have no legacy systems from any of the acquisitions. They're on our systems. We have total transparency and control at closing. And that's how we do it.
First and foremost, and to close, I'd like to say, John, thank you so much for joining us on the Professionally Cannabis podcast. You mentioned before that this is the first time that we've spoken, and I can guarantee you it will not be the last. We really look forward to welcoming you back onto the pod. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thank you for having me.
Please take me above. Take me with